If you were going to tell a story that had the power to change the world, how would you do it? Wouldn't it be with shouts and spectacle, with grand display and great volume? Well, instead, Frederick Buechner observes this about the resurrection. It has always struck me as remarkable that when the writers of the four Gospels come to the most important part of the story that they have to tell, they tell it in whispers. There's no choir of angels to proclaim it, no sudden explosion in the sky, not a single soul around to see it happen. That is not the way the Gospels tell it. They are not trying to describe it as convincingly as they can. They are trying to describe it as truthfully as they can. And truthfully, maybe a whisper is the most that they can offer. And so we have to listen carefully for those hushed whispers. We have to be open-eyed and watchful for the flickers of light, the glimpses of new life there are to see. But Thomas needs more than that. Thomas needed more than a whisper. It's a week after Easter for Thomas, no less than us. A week later, our passage says, the disciples were in the house and Thomas was with them. And over the span of that week, Thomas has been looking and listening, but he's seen very little. He's heard only the fantastic tale from his friends and fellow disciples of Jesus coming back to them on the evening of that resurrection day, saying, "Peace be with you," breathing on them as the wind of the Spirit just moved through them all. But Thomas, John says, was not with them when Jesus came. He missed it. We don't know why he's off by himself on that Easter day as Jesus enters that locked room with those cowering disciples. Some have speculated that the room was starting to feel confining and heavy to him. Or maybe he needed to get some fresh air or just a moment alone to gather himself. Or maybe he's out buying food for the group. Ever the pragmatic realist, somebody has to take care of things after all. Maybe it's spring break and he's away at the beach. We don't know why he missed Easter, unless we know precisely why. He's off by himself because he's avoiding it all, don't you think? It's all too real and too painful. For all that he knows, his rabbi and leader is dead and buried and rolled behind a stone. And behind that stone with Jesus is so much of Thomas's own life, his vision, his sense of direction, his hope, so much of it entombed there with Jesus, with failure and loss lingering behind in his place. And with it, maybe there's shame that he had deserted Jesus along with the others. Perhaps there's disappointment in himself. There's definitely some disillusionment and possibly even a bit of resentment. Can you imagine it? Resentment towards the one who had raised his hopes so high only to leave him. And so we're not surprised that Thomas leaves. He isolates himself and then he returns wondering if it's all true. He's known as doubting Thomas in Christian tradition, but the Gospels never call him that. In fact, twice in John, including in this passage, he's described with the title the twin, which is a more fitting name for him. Some throughout history have seen him as the twin to Jesus, but I wonder if he doesn't look a lot like me. And I bet you can find a resemblance to Thomas too, because church is full of Thomases. We can see ourselves in his doubts, in his needs, in his tendency to avoid the crowd, in his propensity to suppress any hopes for fear of being disappointed all over again. As the poet Denise Levertov puts it in her poem, St. Thomas Didymus, "Thomas, called the twin because he is my twin," she writes. Embracing Thomas as our twin, it allows us to acknowledge the experience of all of us doubting believers or believing doubters, to claim his story as our own story. We know him well, as we know well what it means for doubts and questions to be wrapped up together as an essential part of faith. But there are different kinds of doubt, at least two as far as I can see. And our passage gives evidence of both. In the first kind of doubt we might call intellectual. It's doubt that is focused on claims and propositions that we measure and that we struggle to rationally grant as true. Claims, for instance, like Jesus has risen from the dead, or he came back to us, he came right through these locked doors, he stood among us, he showed us his wounds. Claims like he breathed on us, he gave us his spirit. Well, did that really happen? That's the kind of doubt that's represented in Thomas, a doubt that so many of us experience in our own ways at various points in our lives of faith. And perhaps we forget too easily that this is actually a form of doubt that we see throughout the gospel stories of resurrection themselves, because one of the recurring themes of the gospel accounts is all of the varied ways that people strain to hear the whisper. How even the disciples closest to Jesus, they struggle to perceive it and to believe it and to grant that it's true. Notice the risen Jesus isn't recognized by anyone right at first. In John's gospel, Mary Magdalene thinks he looks like the local gardener. And later, the disciples don't recognize him on the beach. And then in the gospel of Luke, two followers have this lengthy, extended conversation with him on the Emmaus road before realizing who was with them all along. Yes, Jesus is back, but even his closest followers, they take time to grasp it, to hear him, to recognize him, to believe that he is risen indeed. My friend and fellow pastor, Scott Dickerson, was traveling in Israel some years ago and spent a lot of time in and around Jerusalem, including a stop at a small garden that's at the foot of the Mount of Olives. It's traditionally known as the Garden of Gethsemane. And there is at this site, like a lot of the Holy Land sites, a church. It's known as the Church of All Nations. And outside the church, there is this terrace where groups gather and assemble before entering the church. And so as Scott's group assembled on the terrace, he noticed this old metal sign attached to one of the stone pillars at the front of the church. Letters were worn and faded, but still there's this message across the top: please, no explanations inside the church. Now, in the language of Holy Land tours, explanations are the comments and commentaries that are provided by tour guides. And so, literally, the sign is saying that they want you to keep the noise down inside their church. No explanations, meaning don't huddle around your tour guide inside the church as they offer all of their comments about what they know. But of course, that sign, it could be posted across the entirety of the story that follows Gethsemane. It could be posted on the pillars of First Baptist Greensboro in any local church. No explanations inside the church. Because rational explanation, any sort of comment, that's not what prompts belief. And facts and arguments, they don't change lives. It's only encounter and experience. And that's what Thomas needed no less than any other disciple. The theologian Karl Barth has pointed out that miracle stories and resurrection stories, most of all, they are designed primarily to astonish us. And what is astonishment but a mix of belief and disbelief both? And so Thomas is in many ways a representative of all of their doubts strewn throughout the story, all of our doubts and questions too, that extend beyond explanation to the evidence that comes when we meet the risen Christ in ways that are personal and intimate and lived. And perhaps the most striking and powerful thing about this story is not the fact that Thomas doubts, but the fact that his doubts are public, that he voices them, that he finds space for them there in that room. Thomas was with them, John says. He had returned to his community, this tiny band of followers, all of them uncertain of just what was next. And in that room, to that community, he was able to express his doubts and questions without any shame or guilt, without any stereotype or title applied to him. And I'd like to think that many of them could see something of themselves in his questions. Are you sure he came back? What did he look like? Did you touch him? And how can you be certain that it was actually him? And if that safety of community isn't enough, in those moments, Jesus enters. And Jesus receives him just as he is, complete with all of his wonderings and questions and doubts. Some of you may have seen Caravaggio's famous painting, The Incredulity of Thomas. The Incredulity of Thomas. And in it, Jesus appears to Thomas. And Thomas is leaned over and he's looking intently at Jesus' wounds. He's peering as he thrusts his finger into Jesus' side. But what is striking about this painting is that Jesus is not viewing Thomas with any sort of accusation. He has no expression on his face that says, there, are you finally satisfied now? Can we get on with it? What does it take to convince you, doubting Thomas? No, instead, Jesus is looking down at Thomas with love, with compassion, with understanding. He is guiding Thomas's hand into the hole in his side where he can touch him and experience him himself, which is what Christ does for all of us with our intellectual doubts, our rational questions, our intent for explanation. Put your hand here, he says. Encounter me. Experience me. Find out how that can change your life. Because there's another kind of doubt. It is not intellectual or based in rational thought. No, over against this kind of intellectual doubt, I would call it practical doubt. Doubt that is based entirely in our behavior. The doubt and the disbelief that is clear when your life bears no evidence that Christ has been raised or that you yourself are different because of it. Because there are different forms of belief too. And often we equate belief in God or belief in the truth of a risen Messiah, of new life in Christ, with this assent to a certain set of principles or intellectual propositions. I believe we might recite or rehearse with generations before us, but then what difference does that belief make? Does it change you? Does it cause you to love more elegantly, to live more gracefully, to embrace more openly, to speak more boldly? Because let's not forget that hatred and bigotry, it comes from mouths that have confessed, I believe, or Christ is risen indeed. And let's not move past the amount of violence that is perpetrated by those who have called themselves Christian. Just yesterday, San Diego, the horrible act of violence at the Chabad synagogue on the last day of Passover, by one who identifies himself not only as a nationalist, not only as an extremist, but who identifies himself as a Christian, and who in rambling, hysterical writing blames Jews for the death of Jesus as a key motivator for his unspeakable act yesterday. One of history's longest lies, as some have called it, a lie that has fueled racism and hatred and unspeakable violence in so many forms. Even in this passage, in John's Gospel, we read the doors were locked there for fear of the Jews. It's a disturbing image of how even disciples can hold as others those with whom they disagree. The Gospel of John, written years after Christ's death, is in part trying to differentiate in its ancient world a Christian from a Jew, but it freely uses this term, the Jews, when meaning the religious authorities, those that colluded with Rome. Because lest we forget, Rome is the only force in that first century world that could erect a Roman cross, and it was the power of that empire that ultimately took Jesus' life. But we have to reckon with that history. We have to reckon with those disciples fearing those on the other side of the door. We have to reckon with so many distortions of the message of Jesus in centuries since. And so we have to identify in ourselves the tendency to lock the door, to fear, to distance ourselves from others, because it can fuel mania and hysteria. And anytime we are locked in place, then our lives fail to give evidence that we believe in the resurrection at all. Which makes me wonder, just who are the doubters and who are the believers in this scene? And I mean from the practical, functional, lived sense. Who are the doubters and who are the believers really? Sure, the disciples confess with their mouths that they have seen the risen Lord, but what evidence do we see? Because when Jesus enters at the start, the doors are locked there at the start of the passage. And then they see him and they touch him. And then they experience the intimacy of his presence with them. Then they have his spirit breathe on them. And they tell their absent brother Thomas all about it. And then what do we see a week later? The doors were shut again, John says. It's a week since they've seen him, a week since they've explained it to Thomas, and yet they are still locked there in place. They are still hiding out and hunkering down. They are, for all practical purposes, displaying their doubts that it happened at all. They are failing to display their lived belief that Christ is risen indeed. So what if the problem isn't that Thomas can't see Jesus, but instead that he can't see in his fellow disciples any evidence that Jesus has been raised? You say he breathed on you? Then why aren't you moving with that spirit to all of the places that it would call you, propel you, and lead you? You say that he greeted you with peace even after you ran and hid and denied and fell asleep. Well, if that were true, then you would be acting like that peace is yours to pass around to others outside of these doors. Because the evidence of Easter, Peter Gomes once wrote, is a reconfigured Easter people. People who are no longer afraid of the dark. People who dare to live by their affections and their hopes, not by their fears. Or as Clarence Jordan once said it, the proof that God raised Jesus from the dead is not the empty tomb and it's not the rolled away stone. It is the carried away church. You've seen the risen Lord? Thomas must have asked. Then what are you doing here? Cowering and hunkered down behind these doors. Will Willimon describes how some years ago he was at a clergy conference where he was talking with a young woman, a Methodist preacher from Florida. And the theme of the conference was what it meant to be born again, to have new life in Christ. And she said, you know, churches can be born again just like individual people. Take mine, for instance, she said. And she described how the bishop had appointed her to a church that had been in decline for decades, a church in a big city in the state of Florida, and there were a lot of people living outside around the church, homeless people. Sometimes they would have break-ins. The church had this expensive security system. It had been state-of-the-art some 15 years prior when it was installed. But one night, somebody kicked in a door, and they came into the church. They broke into an office. They damaged some things. And so to deal with this emergency, the church had a board meeting and gathered together their small board. They started to look exhaustively at what the latest security systems were, how they needed to update. But then one of the oldest members in the room said, you know, as long as I've been here, we've tried to get people to come to this church, to join this church, to attend here, to come into our doors. And it turns out that there are some people so dying to get into this church that they'll kick the doors in. She said, you know, rather than paying for security on this church that's dwindling out of existence, I say we just unlock the doors and see what happens. Well, the pastor was astonished by this, but before she could say anything, one of this woman's buddies sitting next to her said, I second the motion. And before anything could be stopped, that board said, all right, let's unlock the doors. Let's see what happens. This pastor described, we unlocked the doors, and the first night, 15 people slept on the pews in our sanctuary. And the next night, that number doubled, and there were 30 people there. Well, she said, you can't have that number of people without getting yourselves organized, and so we did. We decided that we would fix a simple meal at night, and that we'd ask people if they'd help us, if they'd see the sanctuary where they were resting as something that was theirs too, if they'd help take care of our beautiful building, help make sure that nothing happened, and nothing did. And so they got their membership organized for a simple meal, and then they found out that a lot of people had health problems living outside, and so they asked a couple of nurses who were retired in the church to set up a little clinic just one night a week, and then got some others to volunteer to be hosts each evening. And the pastor said, in 6 months, our Sunday morning attendance had doubled. And I think it's because when we unlock those doors and we let those people come in, do you know who else got in? You know who else got in. The same one who walks through every door that we can lock in our lives to proclaim his unending love. It's the same one that's made it through all of the walls that we can construct to remind us of his relentless mercy. He's never demanded that we understand him, but he's always offered us the truth so lovingly that he understands us. And so regardless of our fear, or our doubt, or our nagging questions, he has never stopped looking for us. He spends our whole lives pursuing us. He comes and stands among us as the living Christ, and he says ever so lightly for those that can hear it, believe. Believe. And when that happens, all that's left is for us to say with Thomas, maybe just at a whisper, my Lord and my God. Amen.